Nothing in life is as important as you think it is when you are thinking about it. This, Daniel Kahneman told me, is his favorite line in Thinking Fast and Slow. My name is Andreas Weigand. I was the chief scientist at Amazon. I would like to invite you to this 40-minute conversation with Daniel Kahneman on decisions and data. We will discuss trade-offs in decision-making, like the current one, between lives and livelihoods. And we'll talk about some of the fears people have, including fears about their data, that their data can be used against them. And we'll suggest some ideas, like differential privacy, that might be helpful in the current crisis. But first, here is the former chief executive and president of NPR.
My name is Vivian Schiller. I'm the executive director of Aspen Digital. We are a program of the Aspen Institute, and I'm very pleased to be your moderator for this session, and I'm incredibly excited to hear the conversation. The topic of this conversation is incredibly timely, not just because we're in the middle of a pandemic, but because of the particular moment of the pandemic that we're in. We're now 8 weeks into lockdown, and around the country, in a patchwork manner, parts of the country are beginning to open up. So at this critical moment, data has never been more important. It has also never been so inconsistent for reasons having to do with both logistics as well as politics. And most of all, and this is where this session comes in, never has our imperfect human reasoning and decision-making in the face of data been so consequential. How we choose to conduct ourselves literally puts lives at risk, our own and others. Luckily, we have just the people to unpack what's going on when it comes to our data and our very human responses to it. Their bios are so spectacular that I can hardly do them justice in just a few words. So with deep apologies for what I leave out, let me introduce our two panelists who you're going to meet in a minute. First is Andreas Weigand. He is an expert on the future of big data, social mobile technologies, and consumer behavior. He teaches at Stanford, Berkeley, and in China. He was previously Amazon's chief scientist, where he helped create the firm's data strategy. And he is the author of Data for the People, How to Make Our Post-Privacy Economy Work for You. With him is Daniel Kahneman. He's been called the world's most influential living psychologist. He basically created the field of behavioral economics. He's a professor at Princeton, and a fellow at Hebrew University. He's been the recipient of countless awards, among them the little-known Nobel Prize in Economic Science and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He is the author of many books, including Thinking Fast and Slow, the contents of which will no doubt inform this conversation. Again, we're so honored to have both of them with us. I'm about to turn it over to Andreas, who will have an in-depth conversation with Danny. I'll be back after their conversation in about half an hour to ask a few of my own questions, but mostly to ask your questions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Andreas. We'll bring both Andreas and Danny up on screen now. Hello to you both. Hello. And I will say goodbye to you for a little while. I'll be back later, and I'll leave it to you for the conversation.
Thank you, Vivian. And hello, Danny.
Hi.
So when you introduced me, Vivian, you pointed out that I was the chief scientist at Amazon. And many people are wondering, what would a chief scientist at Amazon do? And the answer is what any scientist does, experiments. So when I was there, we had maybe 50, 100 million subjects. And it was amazing to be able to have hypotheses and to then see how do those people react. Now that, of course, is nothing to what we have now, namely an experiment called COVID that involves 7 billion people. So when I was reflecting on What insights do I have? What do I think about behavior? For instance, how has my behavior changed? I was thinking, are there some general principles that we see? For example, all of my friends started cooking, but you know, this is not a cooking show. So I am curious, what can we learn from this experiment? The other thing I want to refer to is, you mentioned my book with a subtitle about post-privacy economy. I'm taking that seriously. Here is my friend Otter. Otter, the website is otter.ai, is an amazing app that records and transcribes in real time. So for example, if you right now go to weigand.com/Kahneman, so just my last name, weigand.com/Danny's last name, Kahneman, you see the transcript happening in real time. Think that this opens when you get up in the morning, when you start talking, or maybe even at night when you talk to your sleep, and you close it off in the evening, or maybe if there are a couple of moments when you actually don't want to record. How would that change how you do things if everything is recorded? So I remember showing that app to Danny, and Danny, you were quite thoughtful. And the context was a few years prior to that, I showed Danny another app, Google Latitude, which published on the web my geolocation in real time. And Danny said, I'm not sure whether I want the world to know that. So I think one topic in this conversation about data is data about individuals, about the behavior between people, and of course, in the context of COVID, data for tracking and tracing, and maybe I'll tell one more story. A friend of mine went back to Hong Kong and was given a bracelet upon arrival at the airport. He went with his mom. His mom downloaded an app, and he paired his bracelet with his mom's app. And you know how moms are. They don't even think about charging their phone. And he didn't know about it. The next day at noon, knock, knock, knock. Two policemen wanted to check on him. I think it's interesting that we live in a time where in some way, maybe we should be giving up civil liberties, like privacy. But my worry is, what will happen down the road when we don't have the COVID problem anymore? Will governments keep on checking up on us? But I'm jumping ahead here. So I'm just excited to be here. And I would like to ask Danny a question, which I think is a question which is difficult and I always wanted to know. Danny, what is a good question?
Oh, come on. A good question, for one thing, is a question that has an answer. I mean, there are at least a good problem is a problem that has an answer. And that rules out many problems that don't have answers. And, you know, a good question has an intelligent answer and an answer that is new, that has something to tell that people haven't known before. That's a good question.
I also think that a good question is a question which, in the answer, shows you potential trade-offs. That it's not yes or no, but that there are different aspects. And good questions, I think, reveal to people those trade-offs. And then it's up to us, in many cases, society, thinking about the big questions about COVID, to figure out what weights we want to put in front of those terms.
You're talking about a special kind of questions. You're talking about decisions, but questions about what you want to do. And there, of course, trade-offs are of the essence. And the most interesting ones are trade-offs that we don't want to face, because the important questions do have that characteristics. Trading life against anything, or trading love against anything, Those are trade-offs that people don't want to think about. And in some situations, like in the present, those are trade-offs that you must think about. So that's a problem that's with us these days.
I remember last year, I had just come back from Germany from a meeting with Angela Merkel from the Digitalrat, the Digital Advisory Council. I'd also given a talk to some CEOs, what I'm passionate about, making the implicit explicit. And I completely failed with that audience. So I remember showing up at your place and saying, Danny, I really failed. And you asked me, what did you tell them? And I told you what I told them. And then you said, I am not surprised. Actually, Andreas, here are some reasons why decision analysis is dead. That sentence has stuck with me for the last year, trying to figure out where is it well and alive and which aspects of it are dead and why.
Well, about 50 years ago, that was decision analysis in its prime. And now today, you can't even be sure that people will know what decision analysis is. But it was a way to elicit from people both their beliefs about what's going to happen and the values that they attach to things. For example, the trade-offs that are involved. And after obtaining from the relevant people the values and the probabilities, you could compute the values of different options. And I remember thinking at the time with my colleague Amos Tversky that this is going to conquer the world. It seemed to be so obviously the way to think rationally. And it turns out this hasn't caught on. And it hasn't caught on, I think, for an interesting reason, which is that you have leaders in place in organizations who do not want a program that will compute decisions. They want to make them themselves. And so decision analysis, in fact, hasn't caught on at all. I wouldn't say that it's dead, because there are many people who call themselves decision analysts, and there is a thriving society for decision analysis. But the kinds of problems where decision analysis is used, that's primarily oil companies, decisions about where to drill. I think that's Chevron has hundreds of decision analysts. Now, what makes that a good question is that this is a question that the CEO of Chevron is quite willing to delegate. It doesn't engage him personally. He wants it mechanically to be done well. It's important. Billions of dollars are at stake, but it's a repeated decision, and it's when he is willing to delegate. Decisions that are unique and that the CEO or the leader doesn't want to delegate, they won't want them computed either.
What I'm interested in is, of course, anything about people. And if you think about face recognition, if you think about emotion recognition, not only through the visual, but also through the voice, and think about a future where maybe there will be no more secrets. China, as Danny, you probably remember, I had a house in Shanghai for, I think, 17 years, from around when we met to 2 years ago. And I've worked with Alibaba, I've worked with Tencent, and I know a bit on how these companies work and how they think about data and what the role of the government is. And that's part of the reason why I'm out of China. What is interesting is, if we really know so much about people, what should we do? How, as individuals, should we deal with it? And I want these data off the people and by the people to be data for the people, that we actually benefit from that.
Speaking for myself, I don't think I really care, you know, if there is somebody watching me. What I care about is what they can do with it and what they will do with it. So what is needed, I think, to have auto transcribing what I say in my sleep really doesn't matter. It's whether somebody can use that, exploit that in some way. That's what really matters. I never understood your enthusiasm for knowing, you know, for recording where you are at every minute. I mean, it doesn't seem to me to be very useful, because, you know, it would take you in real time a whole day to know where you've been all day. I mean, what's the point of that? That I never understood. But there are certain things where the automatic recording of things, for example, the fact that photographs label themselves, that is, and label themselves with a date stamp, that I think is very useful. It's a feature that is useful. So some features are useful. Other features, personally, I don't care, but I want guarantees that they won't be used against me, or that they won't be used in a bad way against anyone.
Yeah. So my fascination with geolocation is that I think if you know time and space, you can recall many activities you did. Or then you want to know when were you at a certain restaurant, so you just search for that restaurant, etc.
Geolocation is very timely these days because there have been those proposals, you know, and Google and Apple have been developing that app that will use geolocation to figure out where somebody was turned out to have COVID, was near other people. And you can actually do this. And in Israel, which has been following people for a long time, they have that facility off the shelf. Now, interestingly enough, what I hear from my European friends, this is a non-starter in Europe, that this use of technology to follow people around, even for their own good, is a no-no in Europe, because there is a real deep fear of, there is a deep fear of data. And it's true, I suppose, that if the data exists, it's going to be difficult to guarantee that they won't be misused. If we could guarantee that they won't be misused, if there wasn't an organization we could trust not to misuse them and to exist forever, that's a problem. And to have those intentions forever, the existence of data wouldn't be a problem. But in Europe, there is what seemingly almost an allergy to technology, certainly to American technology, and
yes,
to any technology that threatens privacy. Is that what you encountered in Germany?
Absolutely. I have been wondering quite a bit what the reasons are for people's genuine data fears. So there's no question they're real. And in Germany, we can see after terrible things in Hitler Germany, Stasi Germany, that people are afraid for data to exist. I think it's time to try to figure out what these fears really are. And I don't know the answer, but understanding data fears would be a good topic for some people to spend some time on. And then addressing those that can be addressed. For example, the whole crypto world has solutions for problems that initially without crypto could not be solved. Differential privacy is an example where you can learn about the group without knowing anything about the individual specifically. I have some good examples in my book about that. Differential privacy is an example of how we can give privacy to the individual, yet at the same time, get data about the group. So in general, actually, I'm always very suspicious on false trade-offs. When authorities tell you that something is a trade-off, but it isn't really, it is just so, you know, they can perpetuate the authority. So one of the questions I always have is when somebody says, well, this is your choice. Is it really? I use health as an example because I think insurance companies could abuse the information that they see from some patterns you have that you might be higher risk, and then in a very non-transparent way quote you a much higher rate than they would have quoted you if they had not known that about you. That's why I used health data as an example where I would worry. What other things do I worry about? I worry about things that I say that governments will take and then lock me up behind bars.
You know, nobody can argue with you on those fears to the extent, and really the issue here is what guarantees do citizens have in this day and age against organizations and, you know, high-tech organizations that are enormously powerful and against governments that are enormously powerful. And obviously, this is a problem because obviously there is more and more power being concentrated. And we need more guarantees. But ultimately, this is going to happen. I was wondering why you were interested in geolocation, but geolocation data are being collected. There's no question. And they're going to be available. And the issue is really how they're going to be used and what controls we can have. As for health, it's true. Private insurance companies are going to be interested in anything that can help them cherry pick their patients. And in a way, this is their mission to the extent that they have shareholders, that's their responsibility to their shareholders. Yeah. So I'm not sure that they should exist, but that's another problem.
So what I'm curious about is we met 20 years ago and you were in your 60s. I'm now in my 60s. What have you learned in those 20 years?
Oh, I mean, I hope I've learned a lot, but what kind of an answer would you like? So here's a question that gives me no hint about what's the proper answer.
There is no proper answer. I'm just curious, as your friend, who really has seen you in many different situations, what if you look back on those 20 years, what was important to you?
Over the last 20 years?
Yeah.
And it's... You know, it's been work and family all my life. I mean, you know, it's been work and people, so that hasn't changed. And, you know, certainly my guess is that I have forgotten more than I have learned, you know, over the last 20 years. This is certainly the case over the last few years. I'm forgetting more than I'm learning. But I remember reading how social media and any preference analysis leads to polarization.
Yes.
And the preference analysis, all you have is an algorithm that finds out what you're interested in and what is your basic position. And then it presents you with versions of your basic position that are more extreme than your current position because you will find them more interesting than other things. So any algorithm that maximizes clicks or maximizes attention is going to create that sort of polarization.
That is why it's so important to negotiate as a society what objective function we want a company like Facebook to have. For Amazon, it's simple. Buy as much stuff as possible. Nobody questions that. For Facebook, it's very tricky. It can't be the clicks. But that is, for me, I think, in a data-literate society, this is what we should be talking about. What should Facebook optimize?
Well, I'm going to jump in here on that very, very big question that I don't know that we're going to get a chance to answer today, because I want to, in the remaining time, and I, you know, I'm tempted that we should just, you guys just talk for the rest of the hour because it's so interesting. But I do want to make sure that we can get some questions. We've got a number of questions coming in from people who are watching this right now. I'm going to start with a few of my own. I mean, listening to this conversation, there's so many different threads we could pull, including what you're talking about now, which is Facebook and Amazon and trust is a whole, that's going to be a whole other Socrates session that we should set up for another time. But I've noticed weaving throughout this conversation, and forgive me, but I'm going to look at everything right now through the lens of the current pandemic. I noticed there's sort of two main threads that each of you almost in your, both in your comments and in your body of work represent here. One, Andreas, the trade-offs here between public health and privacy, and how do we protect data? How do we protect human privacy while serving public officials? And Danny, how do people behave, respond? How do they process what's happening and synthesize that data in determining how they're going to behave? Danny, in the almost at the beginning of our session, you said something quite intriguing. I want to follow up on. You said, you know, the idea of trading life for something, trading love for something, for anything. No one wants to think about it. And you then said the very, you then followed that with a very provocative notion, and now they have to. So I want to ask you to talk a little bit more about that. We are in a situation where all over the world, certainly, but specifically in the US, individuals are having to make trade-offs in the face of sort of uneven guidance and direction at the local, state, and federal level about how they behave, which effectively does come down to what are the trade-offs we are making for life, for ours and for others. How do you explain how, what is the current pandemic say about human decision making?
You know, the trade-offs that I was thinking about are at the societal level, not at the individual level. For me, the most important statistic about COVID is the fact that, if I'm to believe what I heard this morning, 97% of the death are 65 years old and older. That means that there is an enormous difference and really an enormous conflict of interest between the young and the old. And this is a trade-off. And it's a trade-off that people don't want to face. And societies don't want to face it. And I really think they should. I really think it is important, even if it's very uncomfortable for people like me. I think there is a conflict of interest that we refuse to recognize at this time between the young and the old. That's an example of a societal trade-off that's hugely important. In the lives of individuals, individuals have to make decisions that they're not really equipped to make. And primarily, they've got to decide how afraid they should be. And people are afraid of things they shouldn't be afraid of, and they're not afraid of things they should worry about. And that is a problem. Not so much, I think, an issue of trade-offs, because people don't think that way. But I think at the moment, in the future, in the near future, when reopening takes place, fear is going to be a determining factor in the behavior of lots of people. And that is going to be an interesting issue.
Do you think it's interesting that you identify fear as the determining factor in terms of individual decision making? Point taken about what's happening at the political level. It strikes me, and I'm curious your view, that a lot of it has to do with how worried am I about my own health and my own life and my own livelihood versus what is my responsibility to society? Do you see that there's different reasoning or thinking going on in the face of the same information in terms of my responsibility to myself versus my responsibility to my fellow citizen?
Well, I would say that in the same way that soldiers in wars, they don't really fight for their country, they fight for their buddies, they fight. And I think the responsibility that people feel about, for example, self-quarantine, then my first thought was, this is an altruistic act. You know, I'm told that I was in contact with somebody who was infected. I don't even know who. And now I'm supposed to leave my work for 14 days. I thought, this is a very difficult thing to ask for. And I was talking to my daughter, and she said, it's actually extremely easy. You are responsible for the people you work with. And they will know that you were infected, and they will know that you might have suspected you were infected. And you just don't want that to happen. So it's at that level. I don't think there is a conflict. I don't think that people do a great deal in terms of their responsibility to society. You know, they do recycling, But that is not very, that's not hard. A difficult thing like self-quarantining for 14 days, not working, giving up income, those are the kind of things that people will certainly do for their acquaintances, for their friends. I don't think that they will do it for an abstract idea, by and large. You cannot count on this.
Yeah. The analogy of the soldier in war actually is, that's fascinating. The idea is not fighting for, that they're not fighting for their country, they're fighting for the buddies, but in the end, it's the same effect. Andreas, I want to just turn to you, and then we're going to go to the audience. Andreas, your book, Data for the People, really foretells the dilemma we're in today when it comes to contact tracing apps in many ways. You know, and the points that you made about privacy, of course, are paramount depending on where you are in the world. But does your views about privacy change when we're talking about the potential of saving human lives, as in contact tracing apps?
I still believe that we should have rights to our data, and those rights come in two flavors, if you will. There is the right to see, you know, what is being collected about me, let's say with this wristband in Hong Kong, and what do the data refineries do with it? And then secondly, the right to do, the right to act upon the data. And I think there is no big change in my view that those are rights that should rest with the consumer, with the citizen. And what our duty is here is to help people become more data literate, to help people understand what really is going on, what could be going on, so they can make better informed decisions. I was actually surprised when I reread some parts of the book a couple of weeks ago, how relevant it actually is in COVID times.
I want to interject here. I think that the current situation is one which I think you did not anticipate in your book. And it's a situation where people create externalities. I mean, the reason that two policemen come to your door or to somebody's door in Hong Kong is to protect citizens from somebody who heedlessly could infect them. So, and I'm not sure that people have the right to infect other people. This is the kind of right that can be abridged by society. And, you know, it's debatable. There are trade-offs involved, but that in principle, it is not absurd for a society to abridge the rights to geolocation so as to prevent people from infecting others. That strikes me as almost elementary.
Well, your comments are perfectly distilling the societal debate. I do want to move now to the questions from the audience with 15 minutes left. So, and with apologies for anybody whose name I mangle, I'm going to start with a question. This is coming from Sergio Maldonado, who's with Privacy Cloud in Spain. Sergio's question is for you, Danny. He asks, is it fair to say that there is no such thing as purely data-driven decision-making as long as it is humans who make such decisions?
Well, as long as it's humans who make that decision, I think it's right. There is no such thing as purely data-driven decision-making because emotions and values are part of any decision we make. So data are never sufficient to guide a decision. There are values somewhere, and the values are, you know, you cannot do it with data alone.
Okay, thank you. The next question is from Aparna Mukherjee. She asks, is there an opportunity for a concept like deliberative polling to enable better public health decision-making? She says, I'm trying to think of how to address the data fear that Andreas, you mentioned. How about you take that one?
I don't quite know what deliberative polling is, to be honest. And you just reading the question probably don't know either. Maybe I will change the question a bit and reflect to Danny, because after all, he is the person who asked the question I don't know how to answer, is how do people actually know what they want? You spent your life showing to people how the assumptions, how they think are mostly wrong. And you changed, I would say, the way the world thinks about thinking. So talking about polling, What do you think? How would...
Deliberative polling is a very interesting innovation. It's an interesting idea of having people think more deeply about the questions that they're asked and thinking in many cases together with other people. The kind of the questioning of the public that requires groups to get together and to think before answering a question, that technique is an interesting one for the within democracies, and I think it should be used more. That's what I was saying.
Great. Thank you. I didn't know what deliberative polling was either, so thank you for that. The next question comes from Catherine Myronuk. I am sure I've mangled her surname. She asks, what current reactions to COVID-19 are most surprising to you? This could be groups reacting well or reacting badly. What is missing or present that you think caused this reaction? Danny, since we have you up, let's start with you. Is there anything about the responses, the human responses, either as we were referring today, I'm just going to add at the societal or at the individual level, that have surprised you?
Well, I surprised myself. I mean, you know, it's something that I knew in principle. I knew that people have a lot of difficulty with anything exponential. And that's the characteristic of an epidemic. It's exponential. And that's something that, you know, I knew and must have mentioned it in my teaching. But on March 6th, I was about to fly from Los Angeles to Paris. And in Paris at that time, there were about 100 cases. And it looked like not very much, not a lot. But, you know, it was growing at 27% a day at that time, which means that over a month, it would grow by a factor of 1,000, unless it was checked. I was incapable of seeing that. I really didn't see that. I didn't go to Paris, but not because I appreciated that actually 100 is a very threatening number when it's a number that's associated with an exponential function. So that's one of the things that surprised me personally, the difficulty that I have thinking about exponentials and the difficulty that the public has, including epidemiologists, by the way. There were surveys of epidemiologists about what they thought was going to be the situation 10 or 12 days later, and they were missing it because it's so non-intuitive that when something is doubling every 3 days, you know, it will be multiplied by 16 in a very short time.
Well, if someone like you who deeply understands what exponentials still finds a hard time making that sort of leap, you know, intuitive leap, then that explains why the rest of us have had a hard time as well. So thank you for that. Andreas, I'm going to put the same question to you. What has been most surprising to you? By the way, I got a correction on the pronunciation of Catherine's last name. It's Catherine Myronuk.
Yeah.
So now I'm on the record.
Let me first respond to Danny's point. And I absolutely agree that the concept of exponential, of a process being characterized by the time it takes to double, for instance, is something which is super important for people to understand. And it really is brought home with COVID. But as a physicist, as an experimental physicist, I also think that there is another point which is important to be understood. And that is that measurements have errors, false positives, false negatives, etc. in the tests. And if anything good comes out of it, maybe we get people to become more data literate as they are thinking for themselves and maybe discussing with others what the implications are. To answer the question about surprise, I am surprised how happy I am. So I did not expect, had you asked me to imagine to stay home for weeks, I would have said, that's terrible. Not having dinner with my friends, not being in airplanes. And it turned out, you know, if I take a 1 month moving average or something of my happiness, this is among the happiest time of my life. And when I told Danny that in the prep talk we had, he said, well, and what did you learn from that?
And and what was your answer?
I think what I love is to have my assumptions challenged and seeing the world with new eyes. This is, I think, what... Now, with a big caveat, as a person who has a nice house in San Francisco, who can afford the food, etc., it would be a terrible situation if I was a homeless person here where the situation is really a disaster. But from my perspective, what I learned is being home is not that bad.
Well, I have to admit, I feel the same. Unfortunately, we have so many more questions than we have time to answer, but this has just been an incredible conversation. I want to thank you. I'm actually now going to turn it over to Cordell Carter, who's going to say a couple of words.
Let me make an offer. So I just created a quick Google form at weigand.com/next, N-E-X-T. So my last name.com/next. So if somebody wants to be in touch, has questions which we didn't get to answering today, since I'm home and don't have much to do, I would love to hear from you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you all so much. Please join me, community, in thanking Vivian, Andres, and Danny, the Nobel Prize winner, for joining us today. This is exactly the type of engaging content that we're trying to bring our global community of almost 8,000 leaders every single week. And we'll see you next time. Thank you all so much, and see you soon.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. So that's it. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this conversation with Daniel Kahneman on decisions and data. I am Andreas Weigand. I don't have a regular podcast or blog or anything like that. But if you're interested in more, please go to weigand.com/next, weigend.com/next. That takes you to a simple Google form where you can let me know who you are and what you're interested in. Thank you.